talking about single field slow roll inflation, which is this section. Where VFI is a flat slow roll potential. So who would have thought that this simple looking action would contain such interesting physics? We found by analyzing its fluctuations that there's one dynamical scalar degree of freedom. Engage in varying quantity zeta, whose equation of motion is the Mukunov-Sasaki equation. Where the z that appears here is, I like to interpret it as sort of a fake expansion history, which is related to the true expansion history by this slowly varying prefactor. This quantity zeta is constant after horizon crossing. And we found a formula for it to leading order in slow roll. Its power spectrum I'll use the observers like to put a k cubed over 2 pi squared in front of the power spectrum. We'll use that notation. We found this formula for the power spectrum to leading order in slow roll, where the star means evaluate at horizon crossing. And the quantity zeta, you'll get the same equation of motion in every gauge, and its general gauge invariant definition is this weird looking combination of components of the metric and fluctuations in the inflaton turns out to be gauge invariant. And we analyze in detail the spatially flat gauge where these terms are gone and the unitary gauge where these terms are gone. I forgot just to complete everything, the normalization condition for zeta is this. So that's a complete description of the physics of the scalar mode during inflation. One thing that I didn't quite explain yet is how we know what happens to zeta. We know that as inflation proceeds, zeta becomes constant, but then the inflaton is supposed to decay to a radiation-dominated universe. And I haven't really explained, so it turns out that there's a theorem, Weinberg's theorem, that says that the universe stays in the so-called adiabatic mode, which gives a general set of formulas for translating zeta at the end of inflation to fluctuations in density fields of the photons and so on in the beginning of the radiation-dominated phase. I haven't really explained that yet, but I will soon. And finally, we have gravity waves, which just obey the Mukunov-Sasaki equation with a real expansion history, not a fake one. And they have this normalization with M, with the an extra 8 over M Planck squared relative to the canonical commutator, which leads to this late time power spectrum. Now, observers who think about inflation, who are thinking about slow roll single field inflation, might say that the observables are the gravity wave amplitude now, strictly speaking, this is a slowly varying function of k. So there's just a convention. You have to say, to make this well-defined, you need to say what k you're evaluating it at. Like at the Planck papers, they say k is 0.002, I think, inverse megaparsecs. There's a tilt that tells you how this quantity runs with scale. And we calculated last time that this, just differentiating this, that this is minus 2 epsilon. One thing that I didn't say is that if you take the second derivative, you know, this formula says that the power spectrum is nearly scale invariant. The derivative is here is slow roll suppressed. One thing that I didn't say is that if you, the second derivative is suppressed by 2 powers of the slow roll parameters. We didn't calculate that, but we could easily enough. We could get an explicit answer here. A number of this order of magnitude is too small, at least with current data, to be observationally detectable. So that's why we say that, so this second derivative measures the deviation of the power spectrum from a power law. This smallness is why we say that inflation predicts power law initial conditions. Strictly speaking, that's not exactly true, but it's true to second order and slow roll. All right, and then, and these haven't been observed. There's just an upper limit on the amplitude, and of course, no constraint on the tilt because you have to see power before you can constrain its slope. And then in the scalar sector, we have some very well measured, very well constrained numbers. There's the scalar amplitude, which is delta zeta epsilon over 8 pi squared, a squared over epsilon star. And then there's a scalar tilt. People usually say spectral index. And for purely historical reasons, the slope of the power spectrum in the gravity wave sector is denoted NT, and in the scalar sector, it's denoted NS minus 1. We didn't calculate that. Let me calculate it. Let's go over here. Okay, so this quantity is the scalar power spectrum with the k cubed is proportional to this. So we want to calculate this derivative. Now, last time we showed that if I have a quantity which is evaluated at horizon crossing so that it gets a k dependence, that its derivative with respect to log k is just 2 epsilon to the 1 half. This is to leading order in slow roll. That its log k derivative is related to its phi derivative, like this. This is in a convention where phi dot is positive, a sign convention where phi dot is positive and v prime is negative. Then if I put in, to compute that, to leading order in slow roll, I guess h squared is v and epsilon is v prime squared v to the minus 2 with some constants that go away in the log derivative. And so that gives, there are 3 v's, so I get v prime over v. And there's a minus 2 power of v prime, so I get this. And then if you put in epsilon and eta were defined as various combinations of, you know, v prime and v double prime. So if you just put in those definitions, you end up with this. I'm summarizing the steps a little because the calculation is so similar to the tensor case. So because of the there's extra scale dependence relative to the tensor case. There's extra scale dependence in the epsilon. The spectral index ends up being a different combination of slow roll parameters. Okay. So these quantities are measured. This is measured to a few percent in Planck. The convention, just for fun, let me write down the convention, is that this is, you know, evaluated at a particular scale. If I chose a different scale, this would run, the value, quoted value would be slightly different because of the tilt. But I bring this up because sometimes different experiments choose different reference scales. This spectral index is observed with a red tilt, which is a very interesting observation. Over here, we only have upper limits. The way that upper limits on the gravity wave amplitude are usually quoted in the literature is in terms of the tensor to scalar ratio. So limits on delta H squared are usually quoted as limits on a quantity R, which is defined to be the ratio of the gravity wave power spectrum to the scalar power spectrum. This is also a function of K, a slowly varying function of K. So you do have to choose a pivot scale to quote it on, which is 16 epsilon. So you'll see on the current limit, is R is less than about 0.07 and 95% confidence. So you'll see in observational papers three numbers, this delta zeta squared, NS minus 1, and R. Now, because we only have an upper limit on R, the current observational situation is that we have two numbers in a three-parameter space. So we know this particular combination of parameters. So these parameters are supposed to be small. This particular combination is minus 0.036. But we don't know how much of that is the epsilon and how much of that is the eta. And the other combination that's observationally accessible is this, the Hubble scale during inflation times epsilon to the minus 1/2. Let's write it. So in terms of delta zeta squared, which is what's usually quoted, it's this. And plugging in the measured value, we get this number. Which is very suggestively the gut scale. So if that's not a coincidence, if the size of the observed fluctuations, h over epsilon to the 1/2, has something to do with the gut scale, then the reason that the initial fluctuations of our universe are of size 10 to the minus 5, or it's more like a few times 10 to the minus 5, is because the ratio of the gut scale to the Planck scale is a few times 10 to the minus 5. Now, a measurement of R, the upper limit on R translates to an upper bound on epsilon. And so a measurement of R would pin everything down. Then we'd have three numbers in a three-parameter space. So if we can measure R, then we'll know. So R is, you know, roughly the Hubble scale during inflation. That's because, I guess that's roughly h squared. Well, let me just say that R would tell us the Hubble scale during inflation. Because we've measured h over epsilon to the 1/2. So if you measure epsilon, we know h. R is also related to, of course, the energy density during inflation by Friedman's equation. You know, if R turns out to be large enough to be measurable, then the energy of inflation will be near the gut scale. And another way that R is sometimes interpreted another way that it's often talked about as the inflaton field excursion, just the delta phi in units of M Planck during inflation. And that's true because if I want to calculate the inflaton field excursion during inflation, then the way that I would calculate that is I would write the integral of d phi. Let's write that as phi bar over h d log a. And then this is equal to the integral of 2, let's put the M Planck in front. To leading order and slow roll, this is the integral of 2 epsilon to the 1/2 d log a. The way that's usually written is the integral of r over 8, where r is the quoted observable, over e foldings of inflation. One e folding is the length of time during inflation, the step during inflation, where log a increases by 1. So this is a famous formula, which is sometimes called the Lyth bound. And it just says that the field excursion of the inflaton in Planck units per e folding during inflation is related to r. It's called a bound, which would make more sense if it were an inequality. But in single field slow roll inflation, it's an equality. There are models of inflation where it turns into an inequality. I guess the way it goes is that R can be suppressed relative to the true value of H. So the inequality goes this way. Let me keep it as equals, though. Anyway, that's why it's called the bound. So because of this way of thinking about R, so here are some different ways of thinking about R. The scenario where R is large enough to be detectable is sometimes called large field inflation, because that means that the field excursion of the inflaton was Planck scale. So pretty soon, the statistical error on R is going to get a lot better through improved measurements of CMB polarization. And we're going to find ourselves in one of two scenarios. So one scenario is that R is detectable. Say, larger than 10 to the minus 3. It's actually difficult to forecast the future limits, how well we might be able to constrain R, because it probably won't be purely a matter of instrumental noise and statistical errors. The measurements will probably turn out to be dominated by our ability to get rid of systematic contaminants like dust. It's always tricky to forecast a systematic dominated experiment. But this is a number that I personally think is not too optimistic or too pessimistic. So what we would learn in this scenario, so this is it's called large field. Is that the energy scale of inflation is gut scale. It doesn't really matter whether R is 10 to the minus 3 or 10 to the minus 2. The energy scale of inflation is usually defined to mean the energy density to the 1/4, which is, by Friedman's equation, 3m Planck squared h squared to the 1/4. And then relating this to the observables, I get r to the 1/4, and plugging in the measured value of h squared over epsilon, I get r to the 1/4 here with a prefactor that is, you know, a gut scale number. So because the dependence on r is so weak, it doesn't really matter what actual value r turns out to be. If it's anywhere in this sort of detectable regime, the energy scale of inflation has to be gut scale. Likewise, the field excursion of the inflaton is Planck scale. So that's just by the Lyth bound. You'll get a number of order m Planck. And another very important thing that we learn that I won't really be able to talk about in detail, but I'll mention, is that as far as I know, the alternatives to inflation would be ruled out by this type of observation. The reason I can't talk about this in detail is because I didn't really give any description of the alternatives to inflation. But there are now about 5 different classes of models known that are alternatives to inflation. That's most famous of which is the idea of a slowly collapsing universe generating the fluctuations rather than an exponentially expanding universe. I won't talk about these in any details except for to say that inflation is the only theory where the fluctuations are generated at these huge energy densities. So the alternatives generally make a really firm prediction of R being incredibly tiny, you know, some number that's many orders of magnitude down from the detectable level. So these alternatives would be ruled out. So if we ever observe R, then we'll know, well, I'll come back to this point later, but for now let's say that we'll know that inflation is the true theory of the early universe and that it is a theory which is associated with the highest energy scales in physics. The other scenario, of course, is small field inflation, where R is below the detectability threshold. You know, here the energy scale of inflation can be anywhere between the gut scale and as for a lower bound, the only real lower bound, the only real hard lower bound seems to be that if inflation happened below, say, an MeV, then it would screw up some of the predictions that we get out of the thermal history of the universe, like BBN. Big Bang nucleosynthesis happens at an MeV, and it predicts the abundances of light elements like deuterium very impressively. There's also the neutrino freezeout, which gives a neutrino temperature of, 4/11 to the 1/3 times TCMB. That's also something that's been measured pretty well. So it seems like a pretty definite that inflation didn't happen at energy scales below an MeV, which makes sense because this is well below the energy scale of our accelerators, so we probably would have seen new particles or something if there's new physics there. It seems likely to me that the real lower bound is higher than this, something like a TeV, because that's where our accelerators are. But there may be ways, one could imagine cooking up models that would hide inflation from the accelerator. So just to be conservative, let's say that it can be anywhere between MeV scale. That's a huge range of energies. So we really don't have much of a window into the physics. The one thing that we can say is that the potential is very flat, possibly fine-tuned to be flat in Planck units. And then otherwise, aside from these statements, which are not very constraining, inflation is otherwise sort of unconstrained. In fact, the early universe need not be inflationary. Okay. So there's some debate over which of these scenarios you should interpret to be a fine-tuning of parameter values and which is sort of generic. So to tell you about that, first I want to tell you there's one little thing that I haven't really explained yet. You know, it's sometimes said, some statements that you'll read, that the number of e-foldings of inflation, which is just the change in the log scale factor between horizon crossing of our Hubble scale, like our largest CMB modes, and the end of inflation, is a number like, say, 50 or 60. And it's also sometimes said that inflation naturally predicts an ns minus 1 of order 10 to the minus 2, say, few times 10 to the minus 2. So sometimes said that inflation naturally predicts these. And I didn't really give you any I said that the slow roll parameters had to be small, but I didn't really give you any reason for thinking that they should be a few times 10 to the minus 2 as opposed to some other parametric value. One question we can ask is, to explain this, to explain the number of e-foldings of inflation, you can draw a little picture like this. So what's supposed to happen is that this is going to be, say, log A time. And this is going to be the log of this fundamental co-moving length scale, 1 over AH. So during inflation, as we said, this number, this co-moving horizon, decreases. And because h is roughly constant, it falls off as roughly 1 over a. And then what's supposed to happen, and then we have horizon crossing. Like this might be the inverse wave number of some scale of physical interest that gets a classical fluctuation generated at horizon crossing. And then what's supposed to happen is that we're going to have a bunch more e-foldings of inflation. And then all of a sudden, the inflaton decays. This is called reheating. And we exit into a radiation-dominated universe. During radiation domination, h goes as a to the minus 2. So now this co-moving Hubble radius is growing as a, not a to the minus 1. And what will happen is the mode will still be superhorizon in the radiator-dominated universe for a while, but then it'll become subhorizon, and then it starts to evolve. It starts to oscillate in the acoustic, oscillate acoustically in the plasma and generate a CMB fluctuation. All right, so in this diagram, there might be some, if this is today, so that the scale factor is 1, and this is the largest mode that we can see in the CMB, a mode of co-moving wave number h0 to the minus 1. Well, there's some band of scales that we can observe. Like in the CMB, we can observe from, say, h naught to the minus 1 to a number which is a few times 10 to the 3 times h naught to the minus 1. So we know that inflation definitely had to last for enough e-foldings to generate fluctuations at all of these wave numbers. So you might have sort of a lower bound on this. But there would appear to be no upper bound, right? Like, what's stopping me from just continuing this plot for, you know, a long time and then coming back up? So one way to think about it is that, you know, with this point pinned down, this point is a equals 1 and k equals h naught to the minus 1. Then as I go back in time through the radiation-dominated universe, the radiation density is some pinned-down function. The energy density is some pinned-down function. You know, it's parametrically, during radiation domination, it's like omega radiation times h naught times a to the minus 4, h naught squared. So if we went back far enough, then we would run into a problem, which is that the energy density is larger than the Planck energy density. And that presumably would not make sense. So just from the fact that the longest that we're allowed to continue this curve is to the point where the universe reaches the Planck density. And we also know that we're supposed to be able to continue the curve until the universe reaches an MeV, because we really need that to explain our observations of BBN and neutrino abundance. From those facts, from the fact that the energy density at reheating is supposed to be between the Planck scale and the MeV scale, it's easy to work out that the number of e-foldings should be, you know, roughly in this range. And I've only shown that for a relatively simple picture of how reheating happens. But if we're making statements about what's naturally predicted, we're just considering the simplest scenario. So that's where the number 50 comes from. And the other thing that's true is that for simple potentials, all of these statements have loopholes, but just in simple scenarios. For example, if the potential is power of phi, say a small positive power of phi, the other thing that's true is that the slow roll parameters tend to be parametrically of order 1 over the number of e-foldings of inflation. So it is kind of nice that inflation, at least in sort of the simplest examples, like a potential like m squared phi squared, wants to predict an ns minus 1, which is parametrically a few times 10 to the minus 2, roughly what's observed. Now, there's sort of two camps. I wanted to talk about which of these scenarios is sort of generic and which is fine-tuned. There's sort of an argument either way as follows. In the first case, you might say that, we know that ns minus 1 is observed different from 0. And if epsilon and eta are sort of parametrically the same size, which is what happens in these simple models, then you tend to, you know, find an order 1 fraction of the ns, epsilon and eta both have to be of the same parametric order. And so that means that r is also a few times 10 to the minus 2, i.e. we should see it soon. In other words, and this is sort of, you'll see papers where people do things like they draw random potentials that are consistent with the slow roll condition. And they sort of argue that some tuning of derivatives has to happen in order to make ns minus 1 match the observed value and epsilon to be tiny. You're sort of tuning all of the ns minus 1 to come from the second derivative and none of it to come from the first derivative. So that's one argument. The second argument is to say that really, you should think of the natural physical parameter as being the energy scale of inflation. There's just some physics above the scale of our accelerators. We have no idea what energy scale that it's at. And it's really just a very tiny window of ours a very tiny window near the gut scale that would lead to detectable R. So that has to be tuned. And in fact, the tuning that you're talking about in the first argument, well, the way that you make eta negative and epsilon zero is that you tune the potential so that the inphoton starts off, you know, rolling off of a maximum. If our CMB scales are generated as the inphoton is rolling off a local maximum, then we will be in the case where NS minus 1 is detectable, but R is not. And of course, that's the tuning that we're talking about. But of course, that tuning has to happen if there's just some energy scale that's cutting things off and the potential energy of the universe isn't allowed to go above it. I personally, people feel very strongly about this. I personally find the second argument a little more convincing than the first argument. But I think that the most interesting scenario to be in is the one where we sort of don't know the answer before we make the measurement. There's an argument either way. So it's great that we're going to learn the answer soon.
Is there any observation that would really rule out inflation? Because it seems like there was always some kind of room for inflation.
Oh, yeah, that is a great question. So I did say that the alternatives to inflation tend to make the hard prediction that R equals zero. Whereas inflation allows any R. Inflation is general enough. We only talked about single field slow roll inflation. But inflation is general enough to accommodate just about any, its predictions are always less specific than the predictions of the alternatives. So given what we've seen so far, well, for example, one thing that's always true in single field inflation, I should have said this actually when I was talking about large field inflation, is that because NT and R both come from the same slow roll parameter, namely the epsilon, there's always this consistency relation that's true. So if we ever observe R, if we find ourselves in this scenario, then the next step will be trying to measure the tilt of the gravity waves and checking this consistency relation. But this turns out, measuring a violation of this wouldn't rule out inflation. It would just rule out single field slow roll inflation. And that tends to be true, that just about anything that you can think of to find in the CMB, you can always cook up an inflationary model that's sort of wacky enough to explain it. With one exception, I think, and that is the fact that the, as far as I know, the fact that NT is always negative is sort of a generic prediction of inflation, because the power spectrum of the gravity waves, it's H squared evaluated at Hubble at horizon crossing, and H dot always has to be negative. The inflaton is rolling downhill. I'll say a little bit more about the question of whether you could ever rule out inflation in a few minutes. So it's sometimes said that inflation solves the horizon problem. That's often said to be the motivation for inflation. I don't think I actually talked about that, so I want to explain it. So the horizon problem is usually described as the statement that if we look back at the CMB, so we're looking back to the surface of less scattering, 14,000 megaparsecs away, that the hot and cold spots on the CMB surface are correlated at large angles. So in other words, the conditional probability for the hot and cold spots to have a particular realization here depends on what the hot and cold spots are doing at large angle separation. What is puzzling about this, if you don't know about inflation, is that in a radiation-dominated universe, the causal horizon, the CMB is generated when the universe is very young. So the causal horizon, or the distance that light can cross between the Big Bang and the time when the CMB is generated, is pretty small. As an angular scale, it's only about 1 degree. So the fact that the fluctuations over here, they're just generated, they're frozen in at the CMB formation time, somehow knew what the fluctuations over here are doing, is kind of a causality problem in just a radiation-dominated history. And this is essentially the same thing as the statement that the conformal time, the total conformal time of the universe, let's say the past conformal time, is finite. So in conformal time, and co-moving distance, light cones go at 45 degrees. And so if there's, in a radiation-dominated universe, you know, there's a hot Big Bang, the total volume of your co-moving volume of your past light cone is bounded. And if the CMB forms here, it forms early, then the causal horizon at the time of CMB formation would look like this in the picture. So inflation sort of solves this because in inflation, the total conformal time is infinite. The conformal time is like the integral of, if I write it as the integral of dA over A squared H back to A equals 0. During inflation, H is roughly constant, so this is a divergent integral. So in inflation, we can still call this line the hot Big Bang. It's where the inflaton decayed to radiation. But it's preceded by a period, which is infinite in conformal time. Now, as sort of a side comment, you know, the proper time is also finite in the radiation-dominated history. In fact, finiteness of the conformal time implies finiteness of the proper time because there's just an extra factor of A that helps the integral converge. So I have to say that, you know, when I first heard about this horizon problem, I wasn't really very impressed because it seemed to be sort of a symptom of a deeper problem, namely that the proper time in the, you know, usual Big Bang cosmology, the proper time is finite. A fancier term for this is geodesically incomplete. Space-time is geodesically incomplete. And so, you know, you can, so to speak, fall off the edge of the universe. An observer whose clock runs all the way back to the hot Big Bang would just find that they, you know, their clock is only a finite value at the beginning of space-time. You just sort of fall off the edge. So I thought it seemed a little silly to be worried about the fact that the causality structure is funny in a space-time that you know is incomplete. You know it can't be complete because the total proper time is finite. There is some content. I think the real content of the horizon problem is the statement that, I mean, everyone always knew that the hot Big Bang couldn't be a complete description of the beginning of the universe. There had to be something preceding it. What the horizon problem really shows is that the fluctuations that we see had to have been generated before the hot Big Bang. In other words, everything wasn't wiped out. There's some trace of the inflationary physics, of the pre-Big Bang physics, that's observable today. In other words, the horizon problem is really the statement that thinking about the physics before the hot Big Bang is not a waste of time, because you can try to explain where our initial fluctuations came from and compare their statistics. They're measurable, so you can compare their statistics with experiment. Now, if you ask the same sorts of questions about inflation, so in inflation, the conformal time is infinite, and the proper time, it sort of appears to be finite. You might think from just looking at this integral, so if h is constant during inflation, then this integral diverges barely at the low redshift end. So you might think that inflation sort of also has a finite proper time, that it's geodesically complete, right? If I just have an observer here, going back to minus infinity, then the total time recorded on their clock will be infinite. And that is true for an observer whose velocity is precisely zero in co-moving coordinates. But if I give him a small velocity, then what happens is that as I follow it back, that velocity quickly becomes relativistic, you know, because of the redshift in an exponentially expanding universe. And I do find that inflation is past geodesically incomplete. You know, and there are theorems that say that this is generically the case in models of inflation. It's always past geodesically incomplete. So inflation can't really be the whole story either. There has to be something before that, something for the geodesics to connect up to in a finite proper time. But there's no analog. You know, here we had the statement that the actual observable fluctuations, we knew that they had to have been generated during inflation. And there's really nothing for the physics before inflation no observables for it to generate. We get the right predictions out of inflation just assuming, the only thing that we're trying to explain, really, is how the universe started in the Bunch-Davies vacuum. That doesn't really seem like much scope. Having to explain why there are no particles at the beginning of inflation doesn't really seem like much scope for pinning down the physics of the pre-inflationary universe. So it's probably, well, at least from the point of view of what we can observe, going to be hard to really think about the physics before inflation. OK.
Some people say that you could basically have any initial conditions, and then you have inflation. And so you could have a totally inhomogeneous initial condition, for example, and then you have this inflation with an E falling off 60 or something that blows up this huge patch to such a large volume that essentially where we are, it's completely homogeneous, like a huge, huge bubble around us.
Well, that is a statement that is often made. That inflation, you might imagine, let's say, another problem that inflation is said to solve is like the relic problem. Why, if say gut-scale physics contains a bunch of like magnetic monopoles or some relic that we don't see, where our universe isn't full of them? The idea being that if you just had some reasonable number density, then after enough e-folding some inflation, it would get diluted away to nothing. Or the flatness problem, the fact that the curvature is zero, if we had some, inflation tends to inflate away curvature. I think that sounds very plausible, but actually the extent to which that's actually been proven, I think, is still a little bit unclear. Only like relatively recently, people have started running like full-blown numerical simulations of GR, like simulating all the degrees of freedom the way that like simulators do for black holes. And they do seem to find that this intuitive argument holds up. Given sort of a small perturbation around the slow roll attractor solution, inflation tends to inflate away the inhomogeneities. It doesn't seem to me that there's really like a hard theorem or anything. There's probably room for more work in this direction. So I'd say the answer to your question is probably. How impressed should we be? So what really impresses me about physics, or about inflation, is that it provides a mechanism for generating fluctuations before the hot Big Bang that's consistent with the observations in the sense that so what it actually predicts are nearly scale invariant power law initial conditions, power spectrum. And we basically showed that. I didn't actually go through the calculation of the second derivative of the power spectrum. But we could calculate it easily with our tools. And we would find that it's suppressed by two powers of slow roll parameters. So we get a power law within observational errors. That the fluctuations are Gaussian. Now, you might think that we showed this. I argued that in a quantum theory where the equations of motion are linear, or equivalently the action is quadratic, that it's a generic statement that the generated fluctuations are a Gaussian field. But what we didn't really show here, we assumed that the expanding the equations of motion to linear order, or equivalently expanding the action to second order, was a good approximation. So we didn't really show this because we didn't try to expand the Einstein-Hilbert action out to third order and put some sort of bound on the size of the interactions. In fact, that calculation is super hard. There's a famous it was first done completely in a famous paper by Maldacena in 2002. A classic cosmology paper. Going through all the algebra in this paper would take probably a whole week of lecture. It looks so innocent, this paper. I once went through all the algebra in this paper, and it nearly killed me. It's like, it appears, if you sort of skim it casually, it appears that it's not that bad. Like, there are a bunch of points in the paper where he says, a short calculation shows x, but actually showing that is like 20 pages of like calculations that are hard to get right. So it's a super impressive calculational paper. That's why it took until 2002, even though inflation had been invented 20 years before, to really, really nail this down completely. Anyway, the calculation in this paper does show that in single-field slow roll inflation, the deviation from Gaussian statistics induced by, you know, cubic operators in the action, or, you know, QFT processes, tree-level QFT processes with a cubic vertex, are very small. Finally, that the fluctuations are adiabatic, which I keep waving my hands about what this means, but I'll fully specify it soon. For now, let me just say that this is a generic prediction. There's a theorem that says that you always get the adiabatic type initial conditions if a single field is responsible for generating the quantum mechanical perturbations. How impressive, to decide how impressed we should be with inflation, we should try to assess how impressive these predictions really are. And so I think that it sort of depends on when, historically speaking, you're asking the question. So if you go back to, like, you know, the 1990 or so, before any of the acoustic peaks of the CMB had been measured, then inflation had competitors where you would, for example, rather than trying to generate the fluctuations before the hot Big Bang, you would just have whatever physics was here populate the universe with a bunch of cosmic defects, like cosmic strings, say, that would then decay and send off, you know, fluctuations in the metric. That's an example of a theory of some other way of getting the initial fluctuations. And what those theories tend to predict, because they don't have this property that the fluctuations are generated when the causal horizon is larger than a degree. They don't solve this horizon problem. What they tend to predict is a CMB power spectrum where the acoustic peaks are washed out. So before the CMB was actually measured, there was just a bunch of real basic uncertainty about what we would see that's sort of, I think, lost historically now. So the fact that the inflation, you know, as these peaks got measured, you know, there was a period where only the power spectrum down here had been measured, and we didn't really know whether there was a peak. And then, you know, the first peak got measured historically when this decrease was measured. That was a really, like, important moment for cosmology. Inflation, you know, from these statements, you can deduce exactly, you know, more or less, aside from the exponent and the power law, more or less exactly what we should see, you know, to an accuracy of 0.1% or so. And nowadays, it's been measured to 0.1%, and it's exactly what inflation predicted. I think that should be viewed as, you know, when you approach it from that perspective, it should be viewed as a very impressive prediction. What we've learned in the meantime is that inflation, you know, in particular single field slow roll inflation, is far from the unique way to predict these properties. The nearly scale invariant property is really just sort of a generic consequence of having a theory of the early universe, which is nearly time translation invariant. So in inflation, we nearly have the time translation invariant de Sitter background, just with a very weak breaking of that time translation invariance because the inflaton is evolving down a flat potential. Gaussian is really the sort of observational signature of a free QFT, one where interactions, like cubic interactions, are small enough to be neglected. And adiabatic really is sort of a generic prediction of any model where it's just a single field which is generating the fluctuations. There are many ideas. So there are non-inflationary models, like the idea of a slowly collapsing universe, that have these properties and are also consistent with the observations. There are also so many ideas. There's maybe, 100 or so different ideas for like implementing inflation in the context of high energy physics and string theory, or some UV completion that have these properties, many of which look completely different from single field slow roll inflation. So I'd like to say that the impressive agreement of the observed CMB power spectrum with what single field slow roll inflation predicts, it really doesn't point to a specific model. It just sort of points to an early universe that has these properties. Now in the future, right now we're sort of in sort of a state of like a fishing expedition where we're sort of parameterizing every interesting deviation from these properties that we can think of. Like for example, you can think about, you can try to sort of enumerate interactions in a Lagrangian that would cause the QFT to be an interacting QFT and put constraints on those coefficients by looking for non-Gaussianity in the CMB. And so what's going to happen is that one scenario is that we see something really distinctive, right? Like some models of inflation actually predict an initial power spectrum with little wiggles in it. There's some stringy models of inflation where the potential has some very low amplitude, some slow roll piece, say, plus some very, very low amplitude wiggles that come from an axion. So if we see something super distinctive, like oscillations in the potential, well, then we'll get really lucky. We'll just zero in this current uncertainty between many different classes of models that have these properties. We'll go away and we'll zoom in on a particular model. Another possible scenario is that we see something, like if we see R, then that will sort of point to inflation as being the correct model for the early universe and say that its energy scales are gut scale or Planck scale, which is a lot of information. But that one bit of information is not enough to select like a particular model out of hundreds. So it seems sort of likely to me that if we're ever going to narrow in on the correct physics of the early universe, it's going to have to be some combination of the observations sort of giving us a few bits of information and ruling out some families of models, combined with some insight into high energy physics. We're going to need to have some more specific ideas about how the inflaton fits in with physics at high energies just coming from theory. Now, the one thing that I think doesn't make this a pure fishing expedition is that we're about to cross some natural thresholds soon. Like one natural threshold is an R of order 10 to the minus 2, which is what some naturalness arguments predict that you should see and others don't. So we'll cross that threshold pretty soon, and then we'll really learn something. We'll have sort of one bit of information. Another natural threshold that we'll cross soon is the threshold where you start to see deviations from a free QFT in many models, like the stringy models. I won't say anything about the stringy models other than that, is that they tend to have a natural threshold for seeing non-Gaussian statistics or equivalently probing self-interactions of the inflaton. That is not too far away. Generally speaking, when you cross sort of a natural threshold, I think you have, that's when you should get excited. That's when you have kind of an order one chance of seeing something new and interesting. So we're still kind of operating in a regime where we have good prospects to learn more. All right, thanks for, so that wraps up my discussion of inflation. This lecture is mostly just sort of interpreting and like opinionating on the predictions of single field slow roll inflation. Next time I'm gonna start talking about the physics of the CMB after inflation and large scale structure.
So if you had to pick one model of inflation that seems the most probable right now, could you name it?
That is definitely something that sociologically people like to do. You could find papers that are like encyclopedias of every inflationary model that's ever been proposed with some sort of probability attached to each model. I don't know. I mean, I think that, one can distinguish, people like single field slow roll inflation because it's so simple, like m squared pi squared, right? This is actually now sort of on the edge of being consistent with the data. The R, this tends to predict an R that's around 0.1. So this is like ruled out at more than 2 sigma, but less than 3 sigma. It's like a few percent unlikely. I don't know that, what's simple for us to write down algebraically necessarily agrees with nature's idea of what's simple to implement in high energy physics. Like people that construct stringy models of inflation tend to find it very difficult to produce just a nice simple flat potential at inflationary energy scales. And the stringy models tend to have a totally different sort of action. Like a sort of generic thing that happens is that inflation, rather than happening on a flat potential with a minimally coupled inflaton, so that the Hubble friction on the flat potential is slowing it down, they happen on a steep potential, and there are self-interactions of the inflaton. There are just extra terms in the Lagrangian that slow it down and don't let it go all the way to the bottom. I'm not convinced that our ability to predict ahead of time just based on aesthetic considerations, because it's really an aesthetic question, which I think you're just asking the question, which model is most aesthetically appealing? But that's necessarily a good predictor of what happens when we make new observations. Like, there are lots of examples in physics. Like, everyone kind of thought, like, the grand unification models are so appealing, where you embed the standard model gauge group in SU5 or SO10. So there was, this period in the 70s, I think, when everyone thought that you should see magnetic monopoles pretty soon. Not magnetic monopoles, but proton decay. But the experiments were built, and it was not observed. Another example in the other direction is there were a lot of physicists that thought that looking for the cosmological constant through the constraining the expansion history of the universe was kind of a waste of time, because, aesthetically, how could you, in its natural units, in Planck units, we knew that the first 120 digits were zero. So how could it not be a waste of time to measure the 121st number? It would be a digit. It would be a huge coincidence if this was actually found to be non-zero. That's actually what happened. So my perspective tends to be a little bit agnostic. The case where it seems like we can sort of trust naturalness arguments is what's called technical naturalness, where you're arguing about whether a particular parameter is protected from radiative corrections or not, whether something is stable to loop corrections or not. That type of argument can give kind of a well-defined scale where you expect to see new physics. But if you're arguing on the basis of like physics aesthetics alone, it seems to me that historically those arguments aren't really that predictive. At least that's my take on it. Also, because I do a lot of data analysis, I feel that if you're doing data analysis, you kind of have a responsibility to be a little bit agnostic and not be biased in favor of one model or another.